Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started, stay on or ahead of schedule. Our next agenda item is taking public comment on the notice of forest practice to affected Indian tribes rulemaking. Let's see if we have anybody who has signed up. Yes, we do. We have one individual who has signed up to provide public comment, and that is Peter Heiden.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the board. My name is Peter Heiden. I'm the Senior Director of Forest Policy for the Washington Forest Protection Association. And I just wanted to make a couple comments on the item that's before you, notice of forest practices to affected tribe rulemaking. First of all, I want to remind you that this is our group, the roundtable, did make a consensus-based recommendation to the board. I was actually just sitting back there listening to Jeffrey talk about some comments that were received by the board on this proposal. It does raise, I suppose, a question of whether it is ready for this. I guess I personally would say that I think it probably is ready, at least for this portion of rulemaking. Public comment comes up, the board can modify the rules as it feels, either today or when it's finalized. But I just want to sort of remind the board that we did look at there were three issues brought to the roundtable in regard to this rule. One came from tribes, one came from the division, the Forest Practices Division, and one came from the landowner. We tried to meld all of that together into what we thought would be the most balanced way to establish or to modify this rule. And the important thing is that this stems back from the TFW days. In fact, the existing rule language came right out of the 1987 TFW agreement. Cultural resources remain a very important part of the environment out there, and the protection and correct management of those resources is important to a lot of people. On the other hand, we tried to come up with a balanced rule here that would, on one hand, was strong enough to keep people from simply getting around it or ignoring it or gaming it. And on the other hand, we didn't want to create a rule or a change in the rules that would impose an unreasonable cost and restriction on landowners managing forest land. So that's how we, and it took us a long time, as you well know. It probably took 18 months of back and forth to finally get what we presented to you. It may not be perfect. Maybe the board wants to discuss some of those issues, and I know there were comments that came in during the tribal comment period. So you'll just have to take those things into consideration and move forward as you see fit at this point, and recognizing that there's some more time for folks to comment and potentially work on this either around the board table or maybe back to our cultural resources director. Thank you.
Questions for Pete? Okay. Why don't we go ahead and move in? Mark Engel's going to act as Sherry Felix today and help us with the rulemaking, and in so doing, might talk about what it was that Pete was just alluding to.
Okay, well, good afternoon. Again, I'm Mark Engel with the Forest Practice Division. And Sherry is unable to make it today, so I'm going to make a presentation. At the May meeting, the board requested staff send the draft rule language out for 30-day review, and we did get a number of comments back on the 30-day review, including some concerns about the process. Staff today would like to propose that the board initiate rulemaking. And that's based on the fact that the comments were taken back to the Cultural Resources Roundtable, and the Roundtable, in their discussions, agreed that the rule language is sufficient to carry into rulemaking. Knowing that we do have a complete public hearing process ahead of us in this rulemaking,
Mark, I'm sorry, can I just clarify? You said that after the 30-day comment period, that those comments were taken back to the Cultural Resources Roundtable? And they still felt that the rules should go forward as written?
That's correct.
Okay, just want to make sure I heard you correctly.
So, and actually I have some notes here, so bear with me. The Confederated Tribes and Bands of the Yakima and the City of Seattle both commented in favor of the 30-day language. The Puyallup Tribe provided alternate language for the consideration in the rulemaking. As a result of the dialogue held in the Cultural Resources Committee, or excuse me, roundtable meeting, there is a letter within your packet. I believe it is the last letter. Very last letter in the packet, dated July 1, from the Puyallup Tribe, and it states that, I'll read in part, in May the board invited tribes to comment on the proposed changes. It's our understanding from your letter that the Yakima Nation supported, although the changes proposed by the board and committee are a step in the right direction, so. The invitation from the board is a valuable opportunity to expand the scope, application, and detail of 2120. I believe this is what Pete was talking about, is a continuing dialogue that could go beyond this rulemaking. But at this point, I'd like to just point out that this rulemaking is a clarification of the process that landowners and tribes need to go through when there is an indication that a cultural resource may be present within a forest practices area. What this rulemaking does, in fact, is allow landowners to the opportunity to submit an application, notify the tribes, work with the tribes, and then have the application approved within the time limit. So it's a change in which we believe will streamline the permitting process and allow open constructive dialogue between the landowners and tribes. So staff is requesting the board initiate rulemaking for the current language that you received and reviewed in your 30-day review.
Okay, thank you, Mark. So before us is we are past the 101 and 30-day comment period, and we are at the point of moving forward with a CR 102 with the language as it is in our packets. Questions for Mark or comments?
Mark. Mark, a couple of questions, really more about how this may be administered if it became rule the way that it's prescribed here. If a tribe has not identified its particular areas of concern around cultural resources, because each tribe is asked, has the opportunity to do that, how does the department determine what that area of interest would be?
The DNR, through the FPAR system, has asked each tribe to identify, review, or complete a reviewer profile for an individual that will review applications for cultural resources. And as part of that application, we're asking them to identify the geographic area of concern for cultural resources. It is true that some tribes have not made the distinction between areas that is reviewed by their biologists and their cultural resources folks. We are again going to ask them to do that, and we will then complete a profile for each tribe When applications come in, we review the areas of concern for the tribe, and then we notify the landowner of those tribes that have shown interest where their application is.
It's my understanding that for any geographic area, it's very possible, and in some cases highly likely, that several tribes may have indicated an area of interest. Is that?
That's very true.
Okay.
In fact, there's many areas that have multiple tribes.
Yes, okay. And then finally, how does a landowner who submits an application in a given area find out or know in advance, if at all, which tribes may have expressed an interest in a given area?
They can contact the DNR.
But short of actually making application, is there a way to do that?
I believe you could contact the DNR and ask the, I'm not sure, no. I know that for every application that comes in, the DNR reviews it and then notifies the landowner if they're within an area identified by a tribe for cultural resources.
I see head nodding in the back of our room from other DNR staff that you can always contact the DNR office and they will let you know which tribes have expressed an interest in that area. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Comments? Discussion on this topic? Okay, I believe we have a motion that is prepared. Which someone wishes to put forward? Soon. There it is.
People hear you if they don't.
Speak loudly.
Yeah. Okay. I move that the Forest Practices Board approve for public review the draft rule proposal that amends WAC 222-20-120, Notice of Forest Practices to Affected Indian Tribes, and corrects WAC 222-30-021-1C2, Western Washington Riparian Management Zone Clumping Strategy. I further move that the board direct staff to file a CR 102 with the Office of the Code Advisor to initiate permanent rulemaking.
Is there a second? Thank you. Seconded by Dave. Thank you. Discussion? Yes.
I'd like to propose a very slight modification to this, and let me provide a little rationale first, and then I'll give some language. The way that in which this is proposed, I certainly have no disagreement, with the necessity to contact the tribes, with the opportunity for the tribes to consult, and the responsibility on all of our parts to do that. So what I am considering would not change that at all. It would simply allow a slightly different opportunity in which that could occur that I think could be a lot simpler when it's utilized and less expensive for those that would have to do it. As was pointed out by Mark, in response to my question, there are often multiple tribes that have interest in a given area. And it's my experience as a landowner that we really don't know that information until we've actually filed an application. And it may be different for this section and different for that section and different for another section. So it's not anything that is quite consistent. In our small area of the North Olympic Peninsula, it's common that five individual tribes can have indicated an area of interest on any given piece of property. And that's just the local ones. There could also be those from outside of our local area that somewhere in the Puget Sound Basin, for example, that may also have expressed that interest. So this gets down to the very final part around notification to provide an assurance that an effort has been made to contact the tribe if they have expressed an interest. The way in which this is written right now even if there's a email and telephone history that contact has been made, there is still a further requirement to write a certified letter to those tribes if they have not officially responded to the DNR or back to the landowner, and then to provide that proof back to the department before an application can be approved. So even though we may have gone through all of the steps and the tribe may have not responded, we now then have to send certified letters to each one of those for every, for the most part, every application, because where a tribe has not indicated an area of cultural resources interest, the DNR uses their area of interest, which is essentially, again, in our experience, from the valley bottom to the ridgetop. They are legitimately concerned about those issues. I have no question or argument with that. But that opens the universe of forest practices to essentially everything. Harvesting, road building, road maintenance, aerial spraying, whatever has to go through an FPA will then have to go through this requirement, potentially, to send a certified letter to that tribe in order to assure DNR that all these steps have been followed. My suggestion is quite simple. It's one word. And I think most of you, I was able to provide this to take a look at before, but I may not have gotten there, all of you. At the end of subparagraph C, I would strike the word and substitute or. The effect of that is that a landowner that is seeking to make contact with a tribe could utilize an email trail or a log of telephone calls that were made to that tribe instead of having to send a certified letter. It doesn't change any of the requirements to make that contact, doesn't change any of the opportunities or the rights or the obligations on the part of the tribes, landowners, or the DNR to do it, to do what they have to do. But it makes it a much simpler process. Every certified letter that goes out is $5. Times several tribes, times the hundreds of applications, actually thousands in this state that potentially are done, it does become a burden, and not just the burden in dollars, but also a burden in time, because you have to do each one individually. This would simplify it to a very common used technology that is available to almost all of us, at least, that hopefully would solve that. So I would offer this as a motion to amend the proposed rule language in paragraph 3, sub C, sub I, to strike the word and at the very end and substitute the word or.
Discussion. I have to action item. Sounds great. So that is an amendment,
yes,
to the motion, which we should vote on.
You need a second.
Oh, thank you.
Second.
Thank you. So we now have a second to a proposed amendment to the motion to modify the rule language of switching and to or. Shall we have discussion on the amendment? Dave.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I had talked with Norm yesterday, and he called me late yesterday and raised this issue as a concern, and so I was kind of trying to think about it maybe from the timber company perspective. And but I got to thinking today about, I was reminded or remembered that it's been 2 or 3 years ago, the WFPA representatives had talked to the tribes about this notion of what they call reinvigorating DFW, and how that could happen, and what kind of the interests, how that might work for tribes as well as timber companies. And what it had occurred to me was that when I think about how we deal, Skokomish tribe deals with a local timber company who happens to be Green Diamond Resources, is the major landowner. And you know, we have a meeting with them a couple times a year. at a minimum, sometimes more. We talk about the interests that we have in accessing their lands to gather cultural resources, including hunting, and so we have had this long-standing relationship with the local timber company. And when I thought about reinvigoration of TFW, to me that meant to that maybe the timber companies should develop these relationships with the local tribes, because I think there's a lot to be gained both ways in supporting common interest. So I, in thinking about this request to change this here, first of all, I read the certified requirement for the certified letter notice is kind of last-ditch, worst-case scenario, which assumes you probably don't talk to the local tribe for whatever reason. So I guess I would, my suggestion would be for timber companies to engage with the local tribes, get to know who the cultural resources people, the biologists, the habitat folks, because I think that there's a lot to be gained by it. My response to Norm is how I think maybe this issue can be addressed on the local level.
Other discussion on this? Chair.
Well, I would support Norm's notion of changing that to or. It seems like, when I first read this over, it seemed like to me having to do both things was putting a burden on the landowner, whereas if the tribes haven't responded in the first one, and they can document that, or maybe they don't even want to do a telephone or email, they just want to send out the certified letter right off the bat, up to them depending. But as Norm says, where you have multiple tribes within your ownership, it can take more time than what we're probably thinking it could take. And paperwork is one of our worst offenders within the industry. It takes us a lot of time to get through all the applications and our maps and on and on. So I would support Norm's change to or, give you an option.
Discussion. Yes, Tom.
I can certainly appreciate what the reasons Norm has brought this forward. The one caution I have is I know that some folks are more comfortable in the world of email, just like my kids are more comfortable with texting, and they have to help me when I try to do it. And I'm wondering if it would be more, I'm not sure what the word is, appropriate is not the right word, but if it would be more comfortable to the tribes if we gave an option in here that where Norm's option would kick in upon the approval of the individual tribe. So if they're comfortable in that approach, then I think the last thing we want to do is have this become an issue, a negative issue. So I just throw that out there, is allow the tribes, in a sense, to check the box that yes, they'd be comfortable receiving something via email rather than by certified mail.
Paula? I'm wondering if I could hear from, or if we could hear from Jeffrey and Pete about the discussion at the roundtable in terms of what led to this particular language. So I seem to remember we broached it a little bit at the last meeting, and that there was some, it sounded like the committee had spent quite a bit of time on it, and I would just find it helpful to refresh our memories about why it's structured the way it is to kind of help with our decision making. Would our co-chairs of the Cultural Resources Roundtable please join us up at the table? Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Jeffrey. So if you could
speak to this topic. I don't think we spent a lot of time looking at this. The primary issue is
is what did the landowner actually make a contact? This is what was in my mind while I was thinking about this. Did the landowner actually make the contact or try to make the contact? And most responsible landowners will follow the rules to do that. I mean, essentially all of them will. But there are individual landowners out there who may not do that. And so the idea was some assurance. Now, we have electronically, we have assurance through email receipts. I mean, you can send an email to somebody and get an email back that says they opened it. Now, that doesn't mean they read it, but that doesn't mean they read the letter either. So that would be an assurance that the recipient, claimed recipient, actually did receive it. I mean, that's the key here. And when I said earlier, we try to come up with something that would limit the opportunities. Well, let me back up. This all depends on everyone's good intentions and good will when it comes to this particular rule. The tribes can't use this inappropriately to accomplish some other goal they might have, conceivably. And at the same time, the landowners have to be responsive and to the tribal interests in cultural resources. That's how this is supposed to work. So when it came to the notification, we just wanted to be sure that indeed the landowner was being honest about his efforts to contact the tribe. And that was the point of it. And it's just a little bit of assurance. So someone in the committee suggested, well, in certain other instances, people use the certified letter as the way to do that, so that got written down. At the time, I don't know that we thought this was going to be happening all that much, but Norm points out that, and the reason, one of the reasons we took the rule on in the first place was a landowner that came to us, who was in Central Cascades, and he, along with the other tribes that had claimed, or not claimed, but had indicated an interest in the property that he was going to operate on, was the Lummi Nation. Well, that's, you know, 100 miles away. And he was unable to get any response out of the Lummi Nation, and as a result of that, was not able to get a complete application and couldn't proceed with his work. So he needed some method to be able to indicate to DNR that he had made a good faith effort to contact each of the tribes that DNR said he was supposed to contact. So that's how it came to us in the first place. I think in Norm's example, and from what David has said, yeah, I hope, and I'm sure Norm has good relations, or hopefully good relations with all five of his local tribes, but I doubt that he has any relationship, particularly with the Lummi folks, who may well see their influence to be wider than other tribes may. And so that is kind of what's behind this from my point of view. But no, we did not spend a terrific amount of time deciding on that particular issue. It came up as seemed like a solution. That was what was put forward.
It did take a while for all of these ideas to take shape and form. They represent the culmination of a lot of discussion about a lot of things that might happen during the process, or the efforts to pretty much close this loop. I would recall item C2, the certified letter with the signed return receipt, as more or less as being considered as the last resort that the forest landowner would undertake in order to provide credible documentation to the agency that they had been making good faith efforts to contact the tribe. That was after the telephone and email attempts had been undertaken and that type of thing. I don't think, and whether or not one could supplement the other, whether or not the telephone, as I remember, it wasn't presentation of the telephone and email attempts to meet with the tribes just wasn't compelling enough for, as I remember, the departmental representative to consider that it was sufficient to demonstrate that the good faith effort had actually been completed in full. That they really felt that this certified letter was what they would need in order to have the, I guess, legally convincing, to be a legally convincing demonstration. But without Sherry being here, and I'm thinking that this is something that this was a topic that she carried forward as much as anybody else on committee as a need. So without her being here, it's a little unfair to provide second guess her opinion or the input she might have. One thing I guess I would like to offer in relation to this concept of the letter and whether or not it's sufficient or could be sufficient. In some of the consultation literature that I've been reviewing, it does speak about certified mail in comparison to telephone and emails, and it also talks about what might be sufficient when it comes to consulting with tribes. It more or less, it's the ideas that I think are helpful here that I'll put my finger on here in a second, are that when it comes to consultation, written correspondence is in itself insufficient unless it's accompanied by telephone or direct contact. So people that work with consultation, with tribal consultation all the time, don't consider just providing written correspondence, even as a certified letter, to be sufficient as meeting the intent of consultation. That a certified letter does serve to verify notification, but is inadequate for establishing that good faith efforts to enter into consultation have been made. You need that extra measure of telephone and email contacts, something to try to get it to be face-to-face if at all possible. But that when it comes to, but that accept and establish, but that where there are established relationships, where mail communication is mutually agreed to be sufficient, then that could suffice. But it needs to, again, be an established relationship where mail communication is agreed to be sufficient. As the surrogate for something like this or to find that.
Thank you.
Okay. You may have a suggestion. I don't know if this would get us a lot further along, but if there's agreement, it sounds like there is, that a certified letter should really be a last resort as proof of reaching out and contacting tribes. Maybe, and I'm not sure what was contemplated under D, 3D, the department receives other acceptable documentation, but maybe we could also just add into D or a copy of a certified letter, just to bring that down to, okay, if you've gone through all these other steps, and then that's kind of the last resort. And I don't know if I'm completely reading that correctly, or again, what other acceptable documentation is, but would that get us any closer?
That is another alternative. We are at the moment discussing the amendments as it was currently on the table.
Sorry.
That's okay. That's an alternative. So we first have to decide on Norm's amendment and then come back to that amendment. I, not having participated in the roundtable, while I certainly am sensitive to the issue of contact, since this was a consensus recommendation out of the roundtable, at this point, I'm not personally comfortable going ahead and restricting it. However, I think there is opportunity to go ahead with the rule as it's written, to start the public comment period, allow the roundtable to revisit the conversation, and through the rulemaking process, if we hear that there is a sufficient alternative that we could either move it to an or, which I think we very well may hear through the rulemaking process, or possibly Tom's alternative of setting up through FPARS another method of a tribe affirming what their preferred method of contact would be. I think each of those are items that could come out through the hearing process and this board could deliberate over those when we move to the next step in the rulemaking. But where we are today, because this is the sort of method of last resort, and I know from my own personal experience with email, when I left Fish and Wildlife, I got, and I can't tell you how many emails continued to go to my name in that mailbox that I never saw, that I could just as easily see. It's very very simple to get one letter wrong in an email, and you don't always get them back. So it's, I don't know that that would legally suffice as a means of communication. However, it very well could if we had the appropriate email and contact, and that each tribe affirmed that that was the appropriate method. But I don't think we're in a position today to make that amendment. At this point, I'm not supportive of it, but I would like to hear from others if they have a different point of view.
I'm certainly sympathetic to Norm's concern about simplifying the process, and it seems a little awkward, but I am not willing at this point to vote to override the consensus process that has come forward. I think that's what we should go with, at least out to the public hearing process. And as Bridget was saying, if there are some ideas that we get in during that, then we ought to, you know, we'll take a look at it down the road when we come around toward adoption. I'm very interested in hearing from tribes about how necessary this is. It seems like a pretty simple change, but we just need to make sure that we're communicating with tribes in a way that is most meaningful to them, I think. And it may be overkill to have and let's find that out in the process.
Thank you. First, I'd like to comment directly to David and the concerns you raised. I definitely agree with you that to have the one-on-one relationship is absolutely the best thing. And those tribes that we deal with that are right close proximity, that is exactly what we have. And it's the, I'll call it the outlier, the one that isn't geographically located close to us, that are the ones that theoretically present much more of this issue than those that we deal with on a very regular basis. I certainly appreciate that concern, and we do have that good working relationship. The reality that we face is that often no response is considered to be a response from almost anybody, a tribal group, anybody else. And it's sort of like not turning your vote in on a school levy. It's the same as voting no, because the levy may not reach the required number of votes. Well, the same thing occurs with this. If there is no response and repeated efforts still result in no response, and then there's a requirement to send out a letter that you still may get no response, it just seems to be a redundancy and a lot of effort to try to achieve something that will never happen. Again, my proposal is not to take away any of those rights, responsibilities, obligations on the parts of tribes or landowners in this suggestion. So I hope you do understand that. I'm trying to simply find a way that we can do this a little bit more expediently. I appreciate the thoughts. There's obviously not votes to move this forward. I have a question. From a rulemaking standpoint, if this proposal went forward as it is today, and through discussion of the roundtable and public comment and the board at a future time, and there is something that makes a change in that, is that something that's going to be acceptable within the rulemaking process on the timetable that's set forth, or do we start all over again?
Yeah, I'll see if I get this one right. My understanding is that as long as it's not substantially different, so that the public does have an opportunity to comment on what the intent of the rule is. And I'm looking at my counsel to nod if I generally got that correct.
You accurately stated his concern.
So let me try again then. So do we have to go back through rulemaking again? I would think no, as long as the rule is not substantially different. And I would argue that if through our public comment process we learn that there is an easier way to achieve the same outcome, that would not be a substantial change to the rulemaking and would not require a redo of the rulemaking. Is that correct?
You could argue that.
As I am.
One could argue that. But one could argue the other way as well.
Okay. Further discussion on the motion, on the amendment?
I will withdraw the motion to amend.
Okay. With that, we are back to the original motion on the table. Yes, Mark.
I have one omission.
It's
hard to stand in for somebody. There is also a proposed change in the title of the WAC to add the language, or to read in full now, notice of forest practices that may contain cultural resources to affected Indian tribes. So the phrase that may contain cultural resources has also been added to the title.
Right. Norm.
I would like to request that the Cultural Resources Roundtable take up this issue that we have been discussing, and either through recommendation back to us or through public comment during the rulemaking process, see if there is something that could be acceptable to all of those stakeholders that would address this concern.
Yeah, I agree with that, Norm. And I think that this rule leaves the door open for that. And I think Anna was suggesting something along that line. D says other acceptable documentation. Perhaps that's what the roundtable can talk about. But because that's it's or it's that all that or. So maybe that'll be the open.
Thank you.
So a request to the roundtable to have this conversation and provide comment through the rulemaking process to that effect. Okay. Further discussion on the original motion. Okay, with that, I will call for a vote. All those in favor of the motion to move the notice of affected Indian tribes to the 102 phase, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Unanimous. Thank you. Thank you all very much. Appreciate that. Good discussion, and I think we'll get better clarity on that. You brought a good issue forward. Thank you. Okay. Now we move on to public comment on the bald eagle we're making. Okay, we have three members of the public wishing to testify. Pete Heidi's up first. Eagles.
Peter Heidi, director, senior director of forest policy for WFPA. First, I'd like to thank DNR staff for the microphones and the good audio in the room. I think it's very helpful to some of us, and some of you don't think it's helpful, just wait and you'll lay it on a life. So, yes, I really appreciate that. Eagles. This has been a bit of an odd situation that arose around the bald eagle critical habitat trigger for Class 4 Special. And I want to say that I think that the particularly Department of Fish and Wildlife has handled this, given the timing issues and maybe the little communication issues that occurred during this process of the Fish and Wildlife Commission making some decisions for the Department of Fish and Wildlife regarding their responsibility around bald eagles. Given the problems that arose, that I think were basically communication oriented, I think they've done a marvelous job of moving this to the Forest Practices Board so we can fix the problem, so to speak. I think that most of our, at least our members and large landowners, are fully aware of the fact that the bald eagle is, remains protected, federally protected under the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. We looked into the Fish and Wildlife's, U.S. Fish and Wildlife's website and looked at their recommended or required protection measures for distances to stay away from active eagle nests. And I think most people are aware of it. I think even one of our members has contacted the Federal Service, found them very responsive in terms of their ability to come back and check out the situation. They also offer, if you feel you want to operate within or closer to the active nest than they recommend, or a nest site or active nest than they recommend, they have flexibility. And so we think that the rule that will come before you in a few minutes is appropriate. Rule change will come before you in a few minutes is appropriate. So thank you.
Thank you, Pete. Questions? Okay. Carl Whitaker?
Good afternoon. The Conservation Caucus is concerned about the gap in protection of eagles that may result from the rule changes being proposed today. Although bald eagle populations have grown and the species has been downlisted to state sensitive, it remains vulnerable to forest practices activities around nest trees. Bald eagle management plans are no longer required, and without state forest practices rules in place to protect eagles, it may not be clear to landowners that they must still comply with the Federal Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. If the forest practices rules become inconsistent with the Eagle Act, then the state may become exposed to lawsuits for approving permits that allow for the take of eagles. To ensure compliance with the Eagle Act, the Conservation Caucus urges you to initiate rulemaking for the protection of bald eagles in addition to the rulemaking being proposed today. We believe the most appropriate actions would be to move the eagle from the critical habitat rules over to the Class 4 special rules, to make trigger distances for the new rule consistent with the federal guidelines implementing the Eagle Act, and to provide a Class 4 special exemption for proposed activities that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has verified are consistent with the Eagle Act, or for activities for which take has been permitted by the Fish and Wildlife Service. To guarantee no gaps in bald eagle protection occur during this transition period in the rules, and to minimize expenses to the state, we recommend that these two complementary rulemaking processes occur concurrently. It will also be important for DNR to address the administrative concerns related to the proper screening of forest practices applications that propose activities near eagle nests. Thank you.
Questions for Carl? Thank you. Tim McBride. Good afternoon, Tim.
Madam Chair, members of the board. I don't have anything written, but I think I'd like to take an opportunity to point out to the board. Yeah, I will, Madam Chair. That there is an opportunity in front of you with this action item coming up. So I'm Tim McBride. I'm the wildlife biologist for Hancock Forest Management. We manage land within five different DNR regions as well as five different DFW regions. As my responsibility within the company, I'm directly responsible for initiating, developing bald eagle management plans with a lot of the different district biologists that work within the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I have to say it's not adversarial at all. To some degree, it's very collaborative. And I think that this action item in front of you presents an opportunity for you as the board to display to the industry and to the regulatory agencies that by working collaboratively, we can actually do good things for wildlife, for the conservation of public resources. So, you know, everybody likes a pat on the back from time to time. And if you stumble on this and you don't agree to change the rules and reduce the very conservative rules that are in place right now, then I think that you're doing us all a disfavor. So take the opportunity, don't stumble. Show us that when we work collaboratively, it's a good thing. Thank you.
Questions for Tim? Okay. Thank you. Okay, that ends the public comment on the Bald Eagle rulemaking, and we have Dave Whipple and Sue Casey and Mark Engel to come forward from Fish and Wildlife and DNR to talk about the recommendation and process moving forward.
Good afternoon. I'm Chair, members of the Board. I'm David Whipple, Department of Fish and Wildlife Forest Policy Coordinator. Here to talk about actually not just eagles, but three species. You have a memo in front of you from me describing or giving some background information and describing some of the issues that you've heard through public testimony. So, before I get going, I mistakenly left out of my upland wildlife update the fact that we have in our possession, DFW's possession, a Taylor's Checker Spot Butterfly Management Plan, a draft plan from the Weyerhaeuser Company that we're currently reviewing. So that's a good thing. No timeline yet on that as far as a firm timeline, but it'll be going back to the company, and we'll be talking to them very soon. So
Excuse me, David, I wanted to acknowledge that. That's great news. Is that the last of the landowners that you're waiting for a plan from?
I believe it is, with the exception of one landowner, no, two landowners. One who is, I believe they are trying to dispose of their parcel. They don't own much up in Clallam County. Mm-hmm. And another landowner that has no intention of doing any management in the relative near future. So we're on a pretty good track. It's great. Taken a while, but we're getting there.
Thank you.
So I wanted to acknowledge that. And then, so getting back to the topic at hand real quickly, as we discussed this morning, the Wildlife Work Plan contains four elements. Element one is review of the current rules. Owls are on that track. We had a discussion this morning about some of the other species and the prioritization. One of the things that the Wildlife Work Group discussed quite a while ago now, the fact that owls are taking up some time, is that the idea came up that maybe we should start maybe working on some of the species that were listed in the prioritized list that were kind of at the bottom that may be easier to deal with and not take up so much time. And it just so happens that two of these species were on kind of the lower end of that list, the bald eagle and the peregrine falcon. And we always said that we would try to link those two together when the appropriate time came. And we feel that the appropriate time is now to take some kind of action. So, first of all, we'll start with kind of the easier ones. And the first one is the western pond turtle. The only change that we are recommending at this point in time is a name change. There's no change in protection that's being proposed. And the name change is only a result of a change in the scientific community. There's no one specific body that says this is the name now and forevermore, but it has been generally accepted as a new genus name and a new common name. And I will let, actually, instead of looking it up right now, we have a specific pond turtle with a different genus name, and it will come up during the rulemaking proposal by DNR. The next species is the peregrine falcon, and just briefly summarizing what is already in my memo to you, that species was federally taken off the Endangered Species Act back in 1999. It's still protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. It was state downlisted to state sensitive in 2002, and we have had very, very few forest practices applications that have had any kind of intersection with that particular species that nests on cliff faces, bridges and cranes and other man-made structures as well. And so we've learned a lot over the last quite a few years as far as its susceptibility to disturbance. And because it has been delisted, and because we have contemplated taking the action on the eagle, it was time to recommend that we remove that from the critical habitat state list in the rule. One stakeholder voiced concerns about landowners and FPA reviewers being able to still be notified when there, if and when there is a forest practice application that's proposed close to a falcon nest, unknown falcon nest. So that was one one concern that was raised during the stakeholder process. So I'm going to set that aside real quickly and then move on and talk about eagles and what we did during the stakeholder process. This is the wildlife work group. By the way, the charter, as we know this morning, has been amended, and we kind of had to go through that process to get to where we are right now. But the eagle was removed from the Endangered Species Act in 07. It's, as Pete Heide mentioned, still protected under the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, and the Fish and Wildlife Service implements that Eagle Act and the protections that go with it and the take that, that may be permitted under that act. I have invited Colleen Stinson and Lindsay Wright, who are in the audience today from the Fish and Wildlife Service, to help answer any questions and help with any discussions that you folks may have and questions that you have about how the federal process works. We've been working with them quite a bit over the last few months to make sure that we understand how they're going to implement the Eagle Act and how to help facilitate landowners basically working with the federal government for eagle protection. The eagle was downlisted as state sensitive in 08. And just a little bit of a background, as you heard, you know, the population is increasing. It increased a little over 700% from 1981 to 2005. Our status report, DFW status report, states that that we believe that it's nearing carry capacity in Western Washington. It probably is still increasing in Eastern Washington. It's less numerous over there, but still appears to be doing well. DFW has regulatory authority over bald eagles, and that's why in the critical habitat rules there is an exception for bald eagles that the critical habitat state rule is supposed to be pulled off the books upon delisting or upon a set of standardized rules, except for bald eagles. And that exception is because of our regulatory authority. The board doesn't have unilateral authority over that. And as you have heard, effective in late May of this year, the Fish and Wildlife Commission took action and made modifications to our rules that protect bald eagles. And what they did is basically something very simple, and they made them kind of ineffective and unenforceable unless the species is listed as threatened or endangered. So they kind of went into hibernation, so to speak. So if the species is ever listed as threatened or endangered again, they automatically turn back on. And we would be trying to ramp up at that point in time to try to write bald eagle management plans or make other changes necessary to protect the species. So with that commission action, the agency is deferring bald eagle protection to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. That action, however, and as many of you know, created a situation in the forest practices rules because of the critical habitat state rule says that if you're operating within a half a mile, say during the breeding season, and you don't have a bald eagle management plan, your FPA will be class 4 special. So the bald eagle management plan is an exemption from CEPA. We're not writing plans anymore. And so the landowners right now today are kind of caught in a little bit of a conundrum. There are other ways to get out of it, but anyway, it's a little bit of a burden that they hadn't shouldered before. So there is a little bit of a sense of, I think, urgency to this. So what I want to do now is to go through and summarize what I've written in my board memo relative to the Wildlife Work Group discussion and the options, the concerns and options that we talked about. I group them into administrative and substantive issues. And first, the administrative issues, similar to the peregrine falcon, stakeholders believe that the landowners and the folks that are out there reviewing applications should be notified when an FPA is close to a bald eagle nest or roost site. And by close, what we're kind of talking about are the Federal Eagle Act protection guidelines of 660 feet. Landowners need to know about these eagle nests, and I think large industry, they know where they have eagles, at least the current eagles. I think where some of the concern lies is with small landowners, maybe not necessarily knowing that they are relatively close to an eagle. I don't have a good sense for their level of knowledge, but that might be a gap that we need to try to fill. The other set of landowners is an absentee landowner who just isn't around and really isn't aware of what the rules are and what the landscape looks like. So another concern that was raised was basically a need to address this situation relatively quickly because of our agency not writing plans anymore. There's kind of this kind of a dead end in the rules, so to speak. A couple of the substantive issues are that, and I'm summarizing, that the forest practices rules should still protect bald eagles, either through SEPA guidelines or SEPA triggers or substantive rules such as, you know, maybe like a wetland management zone or a snag rule, kind of in the timber harvesting section. And along with that, the forest practices rules should be consistent with the federal law, with the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. And you heard public testimony relative to those. So that's kind of what the process has developed into. And before we move to DNR's staff recommendation, I want to make clear that DFW is specifically as convener of the Wildlife Work Group, not making a firm recommendation, or at least I didn't in my memo, relative to the bald eagle rule change. We can talk more about that in a couple minutes. We have made a recommendation in terms of the name change for the turtle and then taking the peregrine falcon rule off the books. So getting back for a quick moment to eagles, some of what I would also want to clarify is that in my memo, I made a few statements on page 3 under 1, A, B, and C. And after I wrote it and submitted it, I thought that it may be a little confusing. And so the last sentences in A, B, and C are not necessarily the stakeholders' views. What I try to do is state the stakeholder views and concerns and then let you folks know that our agency believes that these things can be addressed through these mechanisms. So I want to make that distinction. And so that's a good segue into the kinds of things that we have investigated and will do and will keep doing relative to procedural mechanisms to try to make sure that the bald eagle is still protected under the Fish and Wildlife Service's Eagle Act. And some of those things are, I won't go into a lot of detail, but my agency will still continue to screen forest practices applications for eagles. We still will notify landowners when they are close to a eagle nest or roost site. We will be notifying the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we have been for quite a while. when we have an FPA, so that they know. So the landowners and the federal agency both know what's going on. Landowners, as always, can obtain all of the bald eagle data for their ownership. That's something that they've always been able to do. The tribes can do the same thing, and they actually have a special part in DFW sensitive data policy. They can get all of the data statewide for bald eagles. And as of recently, the nest and roost site locations for eagles are not considered sensitive data by DFW. And we've recently released and developed and released the PHS on the web that some of you folks may have heard about, which is all web-based. Anybody can access it. Some of the data, like owls and murrelets, are masked, so you can't find out where those locations are. But eagles, you can. They show up on the web, and so you can actually use that as a tool to find out if your FPA, or if you're a reviewer, if somebody else's FPA is close to an eagle nest or roost site. Those interested parties that want to review FPAs still, and the tribes voice this concern, they can maintain, or if they don't have it, they can create their FPARS profile and review FPAs. They can get notifications, and they can then use the PHS on the web or our database that they can get access to see if there's any conflict. So there's kind of a check there. We are fully intending, and we've actually made a really good start on it as far as developing a fact sheet that we intend to distribute to landowners through WFFA, WFPA, individual landowners, tribes, DNR regions. It'll be handed out at TFW meetings that happen all the time in the regions. And that fact sheet will have all of the background information, the downlisting, any rule changes that the board so chooses to make, the FPA screening process, where to get data, where to go to get guidance from the federal website, and all of that kind of information. So we're trying to put forth a good educational piece there. And we're also working with Fish and Wildlife Service. If you've looked at their website, they have a one-page commitment to implement their federal protection guidelines. It's a very simplified way of doing business. It's a good way of doing business. But we're working with them to make that a little bit more complete and have made suggestions so that we can put on there things like the location of the FPA or the FPA number or whatever it takes to kind of make the connections between the federal service, the landowners, and the TFW reviewers, as well as our agency. And then one final thing I want to make clear is that DFW is still going to maintain our database, our Eagle database, that DNR will use to screen FPAs, that everybody else that wants to look at FPAs, it will reflect our database. And we work closely with Fish and Wildlife Service to maintain that, add any new sites, et cetera, through time. So that is my briefing in terms of kind of setting the stage for the discussion on those three species, and maybe I should try to take some questions at this point if there are any.
Okay, questions for Dave? Paul? So was there a discussion in the wildlife work group about some of these solutions that you have written out? And if so, can you describe some of the pros and cons and the reasons why consensus was reached?
Yes, thank you very much for that. So the first possible action is removing it completely from the rules, taking it off the critical habitat state list 222.16.080. That particular set of rules is intended for threatened and endangered species. So some people will initially at least wanted it to stay on that list and reflect the federal guidelines in those distances. the cons, the pros are it's, it still gets protected and it's still in the rule book. But the con is that it may not necessarily belong on that list because it's no longer listed and it has achieved recovery under the Endangered Species Act. And the fact that our commission took action kind of putting our rules to sleep unless it becomes listed, then kind of makes that maybe not quite so appropriate. The one of the other options is, as you heard in public testimony, was to take it out of there and put it under 222.16.050, which is under the Class 4 Special Forest Practice Application Definition. The benefit of that is, again, it's still protected. It's a SEPA trigger, and if the landowner proposed, I should say, and in addition to putting it in 050, the board could choose to reduce those distances that are currently in the SEPA trigger down to reflect the federal guidelines, 660 feet, basically. And so if the landowner implemented the federal guidelines, they wouldn't trigger SEPA. If they wanted to do activities within 660, they would need to then use an off-ramp that could be developed by implementing or getting approval or a take permit from Fish and Wildlife Service. That would be their way out of Class 4 Special. The third option was that the Eagle Rule would be removed from 080 and go into the normal timber harvesting section of the rules, and therefore still theoretically achieve protection. One of the problems that that would cause is that if, say for instance, the rule said something like basically harvest is prohibited within 330 feet at all times of the year and 660 feet during the nesting season, that there will be occasionally some landowners that simply need to build a road or maintain a road or do something within those distances. And what that would then mean is it would probably trigger an alternate plan type of a process. And kind of reflecting back to why the commission took action that they did, one was because of recovery. The other reason is because of staff reductions and budget reductions that basically had our agency reprioritize what's important to us. And it's not that eagles are not important, but we've got folks that used to work on eagles that are working on other listed species and other higher priorities because of the recovery of the eagle. So there's a workload issue that kind of goes along with that. One of the other concerns, I think, under 050, which I believe is highlighted there, it's if you read it, it's those class force special force practices are those that have been determined to have a potential for substantial impact on the environment. And then if you can get over that hurdle with the delisted or downlisted species, DNR also uses the SEPA guidance chapter to help them make a threshold decision. And when you read that, it even gets a little bit more difficult to, I think, properly implement SEPA. I'm not a SEPA expert, but it didn't appear upon my read that it was a very good fit for there. So we are wanting to have this discussion in front of the board and have the board engage in this and provide some direction. But what my agency is trying to do is do it from close a lot of gaps from the procedural and administrative aspects. So again, connecting those dots between the landowners, the federal services, the tribes, and the TFW reviewers and us, and accomplish protection through the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act that way. So that's what we're attempting to do.
Other questions, Dave? Okay, why don't we hear from DNR staff on the process?
Well,
So as David stated, in April of this year, the Fish and Wildlife Commission did adopt a rule amending DFW WAC addressing the bald eagle. As a result of that rulemaking, which took effect in late May, we've had to put together an interim plan on how to address forest practices that have bald eagle nests or roosting sites. So before we talk about the rulemaking, Sue's going to share what the DNR operations is doing as an interim plan until the rules are changed.
Thank you, Mark. Good afternoon, Sue.
Good afternoon. I'm Sue Casey from the Forest Practices, and I'm here to give you a brief overview of how we classify applications specific to bald eagles. And so that's using 222-16080, that's the critical habitat. And so the regions, when they're reviewing a proposal, they first look at, they screen for those critical habitats. And if there is an indication that there's critical habitat, then they look at what the proposal actually is. If the proposal has to do with timber harvest, road construction, aerial application of pesticides, site preparation, which includes scarification, slash burning, and site preparation, and if that activity is either within a half a mile of an active nest site, or it's within a quarter of a mile of a communal roof site, the application is classed a four special, which triggers CEQA. The second look that they will review is if the effect is an active eagle's nest. If the applicant has indicated a time of year when they plan to operate, if they indicate on their application that they are not going to be operating within the active nest season, and the proposal is outside of a quarter mile of the active nest site, the application can be probably a class three. If it's within that quarter mile, it's also a four special, even if it's outside the active nest season. As Dave mentioned, landowners have lots of eagle management plans that have been approved in the past. Regions are very commonly getting applications today that contain those bald eagle management plans. Those FPAs are still classified as a core special, and they are reviewed through CEQA.
So just make sure the board's aware that we're sort of in this in-between strategy right now, where because it's still listed on our rules as triggering CEQA, we have to go through that process because now the bald eagle management plans are no longer valid. So I make sure the board's aware of that, which is the reason it's coming to us today, and so it's time sensitive for us to take some action. So.
Right. One landowner with an HCP, State Lands, has actually gone through the process and amended their HCP to include their existing bald eagle management plan, so it's part of their HCP now. Landowners who have numerous bald eagle management plans do have a choice where they could group those management plans together. They could be run through CEPA as a non-project CEPA, and then as they have activities in the future, then we could use that CEPA review.
Okay, that's an important point.
So are you currently directing landowners to the Fish and Wildlife Service as a potential off-ramp from CEPA?
When this change occurred, both Darren Kramer and Dave Whipple put together a joint stakeholder memo to give some landowners and folks information about what change had taken place. As part of that stakeholder memo, they're directed to go to that site. They can use that site as for information.
And the other thing that we do is our staff, when they review forest practice applications, We have a specific parse profile just for eagles that's very specific and detailed. And so when we get those applications, again, we notify the landowner and we help them determine whether or not they're within 660 feet and direct them to the Fish and Wildlife Service as well. So there is a one-to-one contact that's at least attempted to be made. I can't say it's successful all the time, but we use that information, the landowner information on the application to contact those folks and let them know, make sure that they know that there's an eagle.
Quite a conundrum. Mark, what's the solution?
Yeah. Okay, so with all of the background, I want to thank David for giving a very good background. I also want to thank Department of Fish and Wildlife for taking the lead, community wildlife working group, and addressing this issue. Most people were not aware that the rule had even been changed. So this was a large part of this was just making people aware of what the new rules were and the ramifications from that. So staff, in considering all of the activities that have taken place and the commitments made by Fish and Wildlife, specifically a very concerted effort to of outreach through, again, WFPA, WFFA, DNR through the regions, website, the ability for landowners outside entities such as the tribes who actually want to participate in the program, they can subscribe to FPARs, so they can indicate an area, the geographic area in which they want to receive all the forest practice applications. They also have access now to the PHS site through the Department of Fish and Wildlife, which shows all of the eagle sites, and they can double check, make sure that you know where an application is, what its proximity is to an eagle, and the fact that the eagle, as well as the falcon, have been delisted. Staff is recommending that the bald eagle and peregrine falcon be removed from the language in 222.16.080, and that the common and scientific name for the western pond turtle be changed to the Pacific pond turtle, or in Actinemis marmorata. I probably butchered it. what the heck, it's been a while. That the rulemaking be initiated to remove the bald and the bald eagle, the peregrine falcon, and to change the name for the turtle within the critical habitat state of threatened endangered species. We believe that this rulemaking syncs the forest practice rules up with the actions taken by the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and that landowners will again be able to get a Class 3 forest practice when they're operating outside of the new distances as identified in the federal rules, which is 100 meters and 200 meters, or 330 and 660 feet.
Okay, so for clarity, what I believe we just heard is a staff recommendation to strike in 080 in the critical habitat state portion of the rules, strike the peregrine falcon and the bald eagle from those sections of rule, and rename the western pond turtle.
That's correct.
And no other alternative of putting it elsewhere. That's the staff recommendation.
No. One of the concerns the staff has, and then we did project it up on the screen for people to review, is the putting of the bald eagle into the Class 4 special rule. It just disappeared. That we did highlight that these are, CEPA guidelines as they've been determined to have potential for substantial impact on the environment. And it's to determine that additional information or detailed environment statement is required. So it's a screening. But the Eagle is you know, it's not an impact, a substantial impact to public resources or the environment. So again, as Dave said, if the board chooses to pursue Eagle rulemaking, it would be best served as a standalone rule added to the forest practices rules, not in addition to the SEPA rule in 050.
Thank you, Mark. Okay, so we have a staff recommendation to remove Bald Eagle and Peregrine Falcon from 080 and to rename the Western Pond Turtle. We have a motion prepared to do that. Are we interested in that motion, or would we like further discussion? Norm?
I'll make the motion.
Okay. It's a long one.
See that? Looks first.
Yeah.
I move that the Forest Practices Board direct staff to file the CR 101 pre-proposal statement of inquiry with the Office of the Code Revisor. CR 101 will inform the public that the board is considering amending Quack 222-16-080 critical habitat state of threatened and endangered species to reflect the downlisting and delisting of the bald eagle and peregrine falcon and name change of the Western Pond Turtle by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission. I further move that the board accept the draft rule proposal for a 30-day review with counties, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and tribes to follow the publication of the CR 101.
Second. Thank you. Anna seconded the motion. Thank you. Discussion. Paula.
So you may have told me this already, Dave, but you did mention a general statement about wanting to close all the administrative loopholes and ensure that there was still protection. Can you review for us what those steps are? And specifically, I'm interested in whether or not there already is or could be information on an actual Forest Practices application that will direct landowners to the information they need from Fish and Wildlife Service. I understand the fact sheets they're going to send out, and I think that's great, but on an FPA by FPA basis, case someone, this is the fact sheets, or just doesn't have access to that information for whatever reason. I'm just looking for a way to make sure that there's you know, a clear, direct, near surefire way to get the landowner connected with the federal services office.
And I would rather defer that to DNR, if I may, because they implemented the rules.
Thinking into the future, we may consider putting something in the instructions of the FPA. Up to this point, we have not directed applicants specific to federal rules. The application itself has a statement on it above the signature block that says your forest practice application does not, and I'll paraphrase, does not ensure you're in compliance with federal rules. So whether we would want to include information on the actual forest practice application having to do with bald eagles and the federal guidelines, I'm not sure.
So the statement I'd like to make in response to that is that doesn't sound consistent with closing loopholes and making sure people have information. I mean, we do have a federal law. We have agents in the room that are willing to explain to us how they implement that. I think that's great, but it sounds to me like the result of the action is simply going to be removing the bald eagle from the forest practice rules. And given that a landowner can take action through a forest practices application that could result, if they haven't had access to the right information, could result in violation of the federal act, it seems to me like we as a board have a responsibility, at least from a good policy perspective, not to allow that to happen. So I'm a little, have some consternation over your reply, and I would rather have a much more proactive, safe approach that makes sure that DNR has information that's available to all landowners that directs them in a way to prevent them from violating a pretty explicit law that's got, you know, if not
continued biological, certainly cultural importance in our fleet.
Daryl, did you want to add something?
I do.
Yeah.
So the forest practices application is the tool we use to screen activities and for landowners to be informed about what they need to do to comply with the forest practices rules. It's within the discretion of the department to develop that form, and we try not to load it up with things we don't need to implement the rule. There's certainly lots of ways we can provide information to landowners, but providing it through the application itself is not something I would recommend.
Any question to that? David, I think I heard you say this, but tell me if I'm wrong, that WDFW will continue to screen those applications that come in, that the bald eagle locations of nest sites or roost sites are on FPARs, and so that that provides then an opportunity for comment back by a WDFW stakeholder participant in that process to comment back to the applicant. Is that correct?
That is correct, and that is what we do now. However, you should know that we have one person that does that, and they screen for high priority species. Eagles are one of those high priority species that we specifically have a profile for. In other words, that person has an FPARS profile. They get all the applications that may affect murrelets, and one for owls, and one for eagles, and gray squirrels, etc. So while we do get those, and we do our best to do that job thoroughly, there is always a chance that we may miss one, or that person is on vacation, or we lose that staff person or whatever. So I'm just trying to be realistic that we will do that as long as possible and as thoroughly as possible, given those caveats and possible realities.
So I'm going to weigh in and then let you have a chance to reply. I know it's a difficult one. I think it's hard for folks to understand sort of why it's not included in the application, or why that's not a good approach. I think we're looking, at least from the DNR perspective, of taking our lead from the agency of the jurisdiction, which is Fish and Wildlife Commission here, and their delisting of it and removal of the bald eagle management plans feels like direction to us that level of protection is not needed. Now, whether the board chooses to do something above and beyond that, we have that discretion. I don't think we have something before us today that's going to get us to that point. We've talked about other portions of the rules in the timber harvest section where maybe there is some other approach that could be put there. I haven't seen that, and I think there's opportunity for a dialogue on that. But we are in this time-sensitive point where we have rules that are now inconsistent with the Fish and Wildlife Commission. So, I think from a DNR perspective, administering the Forest Practice Act, it's difficult to understand why it would be incumbent upon forest practices to implement protections for a species that the Fish and Wildlife Commission no longer feels is necessary. So I understand that it provides habitat and there's still the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, and that certain additional rulemaking may be necessary or desirable by this board to do that, but where we are today, we're inconsistent with the commission, and so the first step, I think, is to get in line with the Fish and Wildlife Commission and take our direction from the agency with jurisdiction.
So I just wanted to follow up on Paula's question to DNR staff and maybe to Bridget as well about I think why you're hesitant to add anything else to an FPA. And this does seem, however, like a bit of a unique situation, and I'm wondering if there's any, is there a legal downside, staff time, money downside to adding some additional checkboxes, or more specifically what the concern is, just to explore?
I think it's similar to what I think the commission recognized, that if the eagle has recovered and DFW doesn't believe that it warrants a priority of staff time, it's difficult for us to understand why, because it would be a change in the application, which every single time we do that, it's more GIS time, more application prep. Each one of those changes to the application is not insignificant. And then once it's on the application, staff feel an obligation to enforce it. And so it gets us into a position of enforcing eagle protection rules where we see the agency with jurisdiction not having that same level of protection or concern. So it feels like we're getting out of sync. However, I think if the board does wish to put it in a new section, in the timber harvest section, I think that's certainly within the board's discretion, and I think we should have that conversation. But just putting it on the FPA, it is really not a solution that we think is a good idea.
So it does seem like there's a difference between, I don't think anyone here, at least not that I've heard, is disagreeing with removing it from 08-0, because that is in line with the commission's direction, and it isn't listed anymore. It's sensitive and not threatened or endangered, but it seems like there's a difference between requiring protection and rule versus, again, going back to how do we still notify landowners, ourselves, tribes, other people of that. And I understand that shouldn't be a huge burden on anyone, but I'm personally interested in trying to make sure we close any loops where possible as well, without keeping the bar where it is right now. And as we've all mentioned, there is still a federal act in place. There is still protection in place. So just ways to inform people of that.
Yeah, I think we have every intention of putting it in the instructions, posting the guidelines on our website, but actually incorporating it into the FPA is a different step. So I think we take every opportunity to educate people and inform them and share that information. It's still on the screening, so all stakeholders will have an opportunity to see that. But putting it into the FPA is a step that we've not taken for something like this, especially when it's moving from to a delisting status as opposed to increased level of concern. Sure.
Comment. This seems like a real feel-good story to me. We finally have the opportunity to say that we have recovered species. I was out on a clear-cut unit the other day where six bald eagles were surrounding the unit. It was an absolutely incredible sight. So I appreciate all the work that WDFW has done to recover the species. I think we're in pretty good shape with this one. I certainly support what you have recommended, Mark.
Tom.
Thank you. I think I'm with Anna on this, that I think we got to keep thinking about ways to make sure that we're connecting people to the federal guidelines and acknowledging this. But I think that this rule motion is appropriate. That's the first thing we need to do. But I have a clarification question. I thought I'd understood that DNR currently is scanning forest practice apps for eagle-related proximity.
That's correct.
So,
because it's in the way out.
But as soon as we remove this, DNR will cease doing that?
We will screen for it, but the applications will be not. They will not be classed as a forest special based on eagle.
Well, I understand that. But you're still going to be looking at them for proximity to eagle nesting sites?
We will, when an application is screened right now, we screen for PHS species, and it's indicated on the office checklist. Usually it's that first page that shows up on FPARS, and so that box would be checked.
So it won't be after this?
After the rulemaking goes into effect, it would be included in that PHS box to indicate to reviewers that there is something, but there wouldn't be any change to classification based on the presence of the eagle.
So it'd still be screened?
Yes.
And it would be identified on FPARS that there was a priority habitat species hit, but it wouldn't be specific to being an eagle?
Correct.
Yes. So what I'm thinking is, maybe you see, is I'm just trying to see how much more work is it to make that a little bit more explicit. So I think that's a conversation we need to have going forward here.
But that sounds relatively simple. I mean, so why isn't that a conversation that we can have now and direct staff to? I mean, so stakeholders raised a concern this morning, which I think is very legitimate, of having a gap in protection, essentially. So if there is a process now by which forest practices applications are screened and it comes up if there is an eagle, why can't that piece be retained simply for information back to reviewers, including the landowners, and saying, you have a bald eagle that is within proximity of your FPA, and you could need to contact Fish and Wildlife Service about the federal bald eagle protection. And off you go. I mean, why is that extra work? Because I still hear an inconsistency that I'm uncomfortable with, that one agency is saying, we're trying to close administrative loops. Another agency is saying, we're just going to take it off the rules and we'll think about doing something else, but we're not really going to do anything right now. And I don't see it being all that difficult. So I would like to request, potentially to amend this motion, that there is some sort of notification that is given to landowners and some direct line of information that's given to them that directs them to Fish and Wildlife Service when they have an eagle, and just make sure they know there's still a legal obligation that they have. And I understand the administrative route that you don't want that in the actual forest practices application, that's fine. But leaving it completely blank and saying we'll think about it later doesn't really feel acceptable to me.
That was something that we could, you could amend the motion. If it were to go in the rule, it would probably fall within Chapter 20 of the rule, not in this specific WAC. There is a sense of urgency to correct OADO as quickly as possible, to bring landowners who are now having to do Class 4 specials out of that, that requirement. It is, you know, this would be a good thing for staff to come back at the November meeting with, and I would actually suggest we work through the Wildlife Working Group and come back at the November meeting with a kind of a notification recommendation to the board. But again, it would not affect 16080. Strongly urge that the board initiate both the 30-day review and the filing of the 101 to start this process.
All right, but this is the 101 statement, right?
So this we'll is, right. Out. Yes, this is the 101 and the 30-day review, yeah. So there's a lot of opportunity to change that. Did you have something else you wanted to add?
Actually, it's actually both.
Right.
We would like to the board to direct staff to file both the CR 101 and to run 30-day review in the 3 months window between now and the November meeting. Also, there is a needed correction to the motion. The name change of the Western Pond Turtle is from DFW, not from the Commission. So it'd be the Department of Fish and Wildlife recommendation.
As long as we're modifying the motion, I believe that the correct name for the commission is the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission, not the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission that was up there previously.
Well, we just struck that anyway, yeah. So I think we're okay.
But
go ahead.
I'm sorry. The commission downlisted the eagle and the falcon, and the department changed the name of the pond turtle. So I just want to make sure that that's clear.
Right.
Shane, did you get that? Okay. So we will amend the motion as described, so that the commission delisted and the department renamed. So we'll fix that while we contemplate this for a moment. We are at the 101 phase. We do have an opportunity.
from my seat as the chair, I welcome an opportunity to have a dialogue. I guess my hope would have been that the Wildlife Work Group would have brought a recommendation to us that would have given us something to adopt in lieu of having, having the Class 4 special trigger. Not having that today, I think we still have plenty of time to do it. We are at the 101 phase. I would like to see that brought back in November so that we can sync it up with this rulemaking if possible. Darren, did you have
Just a reminder, you are doing a 30-day review of rule language, so any changes to that would require doing that over. Keep that in mind.
Yes.
And the other thing about what we may or may not bring back in November, the process that we go through of reviewing, processing, classifying, and complying forest practices applications, so that process is intended to ensure that forest practices activities meet the rule. If we don't have a rule, I'm a little reluctant to be directing my folks to be doing things that are unrelated, if we don't have a rule for them. Just so other people have a more expedient way to review information. Now, that's a nice thing to do, and in good times, we do that. These are not good times. We have very limited capacity to implement the rules we have. So while it may not seem like a bunch of extra work, it is extra work. And when you multiply that by 5,000 or 6,000 or 7,000 or 8,000 FPAs, it can add up to a lot of work. So if we're going to ask our folks, if I'm going to ask my folks to do additional work during the course of processing FPAs, I want it to be related to implementing the rules.
So I'm, forgive me, I'm kind of thinking out loud here, but I'm wondering if we could amend or do a separate, in addition to this motion, Paula, I mean, I'm willing to commit that we can convene the Wildlife Work Group again prior to the November meeting to continue discussing notification options. Do you feel like we need a motion to do that, or as a verbal commitment? I don't know what would, I mean, Darren just raised a good point about if we did have a substantial change to recommend, then I guess we would have to start the process, the 30-day process over again, but.
Or we could start a new process. I mean, we could have this process going and then start an additional process.
That's
in the
November
as well, right? Which, with a verbal commitment to do so, is fine. And then based on what Darren just said, I mean, I think what I was proposing was trying to get away from rulemaking and just have it be relatively simple. But it doesn't sound like that's DNR staff's preference. So what I will request of both the FW and the DNR staff is to figure out a way in which to link bald eagle protection under the federal act to rules. So we do some research on how that would be done. So if it has to be a rule, so be it. And if we can figure that out, that's great. And we can have a recommendation to potentially start, a second, not quite parallel process in November. I would support not new rulemaking and just making sure that people understood, because I think it's important. It's cheaper. It's cheaper from a policy perspective. I maintain that it's good to make sure our rules are not inconsistent with federal law. But if we need a rule, so be it. And we can start that process in November. So here in the discussion, I think we should task the Wildlife Work Group with addressing whether we need additional rulemaking to have consistency with the Eagle Act. And to bring back a proposal in November to do that. And we can talk internally at DNR to see if there's some other means to do that that doesn't require rulemaking, but we do, our staff implements the rules. And when priorities get established, if something's not in the rule, it's not a priority. So I think we do have to be true to that. Recognizing rulemaking is not our preferred alternative. But we could have a whole host of things that would be sort of nice things we would like to do that we just don't have the capacity to do. So So I'd like to continue, if the board so desires, to move on the motion to remove, as the motion says, the changes from 080, and then task the Wildlife Work Group with bringing us back something in November to either add something else or provide an alternative method.
Bridget, if I can just add one final comment. I completely relate to, and I was hoping also that we could have a recommendation from the Wildlife Work Group for this meeting. We did reach out, I believe it was almost immediately after the commission took this action, and it did take a while to get folks to pay attention to it, frankly. So apologize that we don't have something else here, but we did. It wasn't for lack of trying, and we'll keep at it. So thanks for everyone's engagement.
Further discussion on the motion? Shall we call for the vote? All those in favor of the motion as seconded, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. It's unanimous. Thank you. Motion carries. The Wildlife Work Group is tasked with addressing alternative means of protecting the wildlife. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, one last item we have. Public comment on our FREP rulemaking, which is directed from the changes in legislation from this last session. After that, we will have a short executive session. We have one person signed up for public comment, and that is Ken Miller. Afternoon, Ken.
Still with us.
Yep, still with us.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the board. Yeah, I still am Ken Miller, and I'm here representing the Washington Farm Forestry Association on this issue. We fully support the FREP improvements embodied in this agenda item. The 2010 legislature put DNR in a tough spot with a priority scheme that wasn't really workable and reneged on forests and fish. To their credit, DNR worked through a contentious process and developed a reasonable and appropriate FREP structural fixes needed and passed by the legislature. We're particularly hopeful for number 9 on the list, a commissioner-directed process intended to develop long-term funding. By the way, that report's due in 2.5 months.
Actually, it's an error in the on the date. It was in the final legislation. It was May 31st of 2012.
Okay, I'll still be hopeful.
And as agreed, I think it's a little more doable now.
Okay. In addition to the unfilled regulatory processes are one thing, but not more fully funding FREP creates a real and measurable disproportionate impacts that highlight the state's failure to meeting the intent of forests and fish. So these changes fix FREP structurally. They have reaffirmed the disproportionate impacts on smalls and have called attention to the critical need for long-term funding, so we fully support it. I wish to also add a PS to the earlier regulatory conversation by saying that I truly appreciate folks encouraging us and me to not give up on the regulatory promises. We haven't given up on the end result. Personally, it's extremely painful to give up on something that you volunteered years of your life for, but I really don't see any reason to continue seeking a big solution in this venue until the board or the agencies direct staff that they must consider alternative ways to protect functions, not just the rules. Economic viability of the goose laying the golden eggs must be part of the solution if we want to keep more forest land forested. And that reasonable risk management is the goal, not no risk or worst case assumptions. We have to be practical. If we can't think or act in these terms, we should quit beating up on each other and just accept that these issues are not really resolvable in this venue. As I've said before, another incremental tool would be good, but I've been giving my personal time to help you find a more final, robust way of fulfilling the promises of forest and fish to family forest owners. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, Kevin. Dan Pomerink is here from the Small Forest Landowner Office to talk about the Forest Repair and Easement Program rulemaking. And before he starts, I just want to thank Sherry for her leadership on this. Sherry came to Commissioner and I in the fall and said, no, you can't walk away from this topic. You must move ahead with new legislation to implement changes to the PREP program. And we worked very hard together to do that. And so I genuinely want to thank you for that, because it was your leadership that made this happen. So we appreciate that. With that, go ahead, Dan.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the board. My name is Dan Pomerink. I'm the Conservation Easement Program Specialist in the Small Forest Landowners Office. So I'm here to ask the board's approval to begin the rulemaking process for the Forestry Riparian Easement Program. As indicated in my memo that's in your packet, if the board approves, staff will file a CR-101 pre-proposal statement of inquiry to inform the public that the board is considering rulemaking amending the rules for the Forestry Riparian Easement Program. I apologize for the error, the typo on the date. It's actually May 31st, 2012 for the for that portion. So I just wanted to a reminder of the board that the Forest Repair and Easement Program was created with the Salmon Recovery Act, and this voluntary program can allow small forest landowners to be partially compensated for the value of the timber required to be left after a timber harvest activity. So as you know, 1505 was signed into law that makes a number of changes to the statute affecting PREP. And most of the significant changes to the statute are outlined in my memo. And those changes include removing the nonprofit organizations from eligibility in the program, as well as a monetary cap on the compensation for areas of unstable slopes. The law also directs the chair of the Forest Practice Board to invite stakeholders to participate in the process that will recommend to the legislature a potential long-term funding source for FREP. And so at the same time, legislatures set aside $1 million for the FREP program, and that's for this entire biennium. And so my implementation plan is to continue to work on the FREP rule development tasks that I've started, and at the same time work on easement acquisition tasks, and with the first task being determining easement values. We currently have 86 applications on file and that are waiting for funding. And my goal is to try to determine the value of as many of those 86 applications as I can in this biennium. And then assuming that the rule development follows this anticipated schedule, the revised rule could be effective sometime in the late spring of 2012. So once that rule is effective, the plan is for me to begin the procedures to purchase approximately 10 easements with that $1 million, and also to continue to determine easement values. So if you have any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Dan regarding PREP?
Just a comment.
Yes.
Hopefully we can stay as close to 1509 as possible for rule language. That would be important to me.
Okay.
That was hard negotiating. I think it's pretty clear, so hopefully it shouldn't take a lot of translation.
Well, and I also have to say, Bridget, that if it wouldn't have been for commissioners standing up and saying yes, you know, he had been picked on quite a bit, so for him to continue to work with me and work for you and Heath was an experience for me.
Good.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. I think it was mutually beneficial.
Yes.
Okay. Sometimes you gotta take your licks.
Yeah.
It's the right thing to do. So. Okay, we have a motion prepared. You can populate that on the screen to move ahead with the 101 for implementing the changes to FRED.
Yeah, I have to do this one. I move that the Forest Practice Board direct staff to file a CR 101 pre-proposal statement of inquiry to notify the public that the board is considering rulemaking to implementing gross substitute house bill 1509 that modifies the enforcement repair and easement program.
Seconded by Paula. Thank you. The motion properly supported. Discussion on the motion.
Not really on the motion, but I want to say to the board, I won't be here for this rulemaking, so I hope you guys get it right.
Thank you for mentioning that. I neglected to mention that, and I'll use the discussion time to do that. So Sherry's term is up at the end of the year on the board. As is traditional, though, we hope you remain serving the board until your replacement is named. Which we have not seen from the governor's office yet. I know that process is underway. However, those take time sometimes. So we hope that you continue to participate until your successor is named.
She has 3 nominations, so I'm hoping she will move fairly quickly.
The request remains. Okay. Let's call for the vote. All those in favor of the motion as written, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? It's unanimous. Thank you. That takes care of the FREC rulemaking. In the interest of time, we are not going to have our executive session this afternoon. Council will provide an update to the board members via email. Any further comments or questions from the board prior to ending?
Thank you for a good meeting.
Yeah, nice job.
Yeah, didn't get us out as early as the past chair. I'm going to have to work on that.
Who knows?
Okay.